It's my job every year at this event to evoke the memory of Larry Levis in some way, and it's a job I enjoy, as it gives me a chance to tell some stories about my friend and colleague, who was also the beloved friend and admired colleague of a number of people in this room. All of us continue to miss his lively presence, but this event helps us to keep him around in some fashion. I first met Larry Levis in his poetry, and there, not only did I discover engaging bits of striking stories scattered as vignettes throughout his work, but later, I also had the special pleasure of hearing some mighty good stories over dinner directly from Larry himself, including the many stories about his childhood in California, where he grew up on what he always called the ranch, south of Fresno in the Central Valley, surrounded by orchards and vineyards, where he picked and loaded fruit alongside migrant workers, where he drove a tractor and poisoned weeds with a muttered Dominus vobiscum, and where he sometimes rode horses, which sometimes were worthless horses, which is not to say that those horses did not enjoy his esteem. It might seem a somewhat unlikely connection between us, two college professors with more or less genuine PhDs, but we both did know something about the peculiar lives and days of some particular horses. I could identify with Larry's stories because I had spent a considerable amount of time in my own childhood working on my grandfather's farm in central Missouri, where he not only raised corn and wheat and hay, but he also bred registered polled Hereford cattle, and sometimes I rode horses, some of whom I could also, on occasion, have to call worthless. I can recall quite distinctly a tall, copper-colored quarter horse named Duke, a horse on which I herded cattle and rode fence lines. The horse was a remarkable cow pony, an agile cutting horse, but Duke was eccentric and temperamental, and like most horses, he could be incorrigibly lazy and downright uncooperative. My grandfather was in the habit of riding that horse out to the location he actually called the South 40, a 40-acre patch of land a half mile down the gravel road and separate from the main part of the farm. And when he was going to work that patch with a tractor or a combine, which he had parked there, he would arrive in the field, dismount, and slap the horse on the behind and let it run back to the house on its own. The horse was then free for the rest of the day to graze on the lawn until my grandfather came back to unsaddle him and put him in the barn. One day, my grandfather told me to ride out to the South 40 to check on a fence line where some Angus cattle had recently jumped or broken down the fence and had gotten onto his land from a neighbor's pasture. My grandfather did not tell me about his habit of swatting the horse and letting him gallop home. Duke had been objecting to taking this trip out to the South 40 the entire way, walking ever more slowly and balking and stumbling as if there was something terribly wrong with him. But although the horse was certainly no longer young, he was not yet in any sort of decrepit state of old age, and I knew very well that he was faking it. Eventually, as we drew near to the South 40, he became almost totally impossible to handle, acting as if he was going to fall down completely, and I gave him a swat on the rear to get him to behave. The horse reared up with what I could swear was a smile on his lips. He wheeled around on his hind legs and took off for home at a blazing, galloping speed, the fastest I had ever seen him run, flying along the road, kicking up gravel and dust, with me hanging on for dear life on his back, shouting and jerking back on the reins, but nothing I did fazed him in the least, and he sped along at a spectacular clip like one of the champion steeplechase horses from which he was descended. My grandfather was an excellent judge of horses, and he always had one very good, very spirited horse on the place. When we got near the farmhouse, the horse, who was completely beyond my control at that point, veered off the road and took a shortcut under the trees lining the edge of the front yard. One of the low-hanging branches caught me square in the forehead and knocked me nearly unconscious and mostly out of the saddle, and I only kept myself from getting dragged by hanging onto the pommel. When I arrived in the backyard, my grandmother walked out the back door to see her city slicker grandson hanging limply off to the side of the horse, one foot hung up in a stirrup, and one slipping from the top of the saddle, my forehead bleeding. She caught me as I fell off and laid me down in the grass, and she looked at me there for a while. And then she said, "My land, can't you ride any better than that?" In Larry's beautiful poem, Elegy with a Bridle in Its Hand, we find him engaged in an extended meditation on the memory of several of the dearly departed among the horses he has known, with a particular focus on an old bay cow horse named Querido Flaco. I'm not sure who the dear person was after whom the horse was named, but it was a bay horse, so if you want to see it clearly in your mind, such a horse has a reddish-brown body along with a mane, tail, ear edges, and lower legs, which are black, and a washed-out palomino. Basically, they're the ones with the cream-colored body and white mane and tail. And that horse was named Misfit, perhaps after the character in the Flannery O'Connor story. I don't know. His parents and family, unlike my grandparents and family, were rather well-read people. Those two horses, Querido Flaco and Misfit, misbehaved in the way of all horses, especially older horses, but Larry seemed to have been particularly fascinated, as always, by the far-off dreaminess and utterly self-contained attitudes they exhibited. Those were attitudes with which Larry himself clearly and strongly identified, I believe. And so the horses were kindred spirits and likable companions. And in the poem, when the horses misbehave as he's trying to ride either of them bareback, he just slips down off the horse and lets them have their way, walking them slowly back, letting them pause when they wanted to. That's definitely not a way of working with horses that either his father or my grandfather would have approved at all. Larry saw those horses as being other worlds, worlds uninhabited and without visitors. Looking at them in the moonlight, considering their oncoming and inevitable deaths, he discovers that he can easily reject the idea of any sort of heaven, which he figures as a kind of rider to be thrown off one's back, and as a bunch of, quote, splintered lumber no one could build anything with. A Catholic boy throwing off the idea of heaven is no light matter, as I well know, having been one myself. But for Larry, in the poem, the horses are exemplars, and he recalls the way that racehorses at the track made it all seem effortless, the way they were explosive and untiring. And then he captures the vast feeling of emptiness after the race is over, an inescapable loneliness, which is in the end always the way of the world, that grandstand with its thousands of empty seats, seats that once held the living and which now, in the poem's ending, represent the dead, including Misfit and Querido Flaco, who have by now answered the call of death with its bridle of clear water in hand. In the end, in a quite strange and inventive manipulation of point of view, he manages to be everyone and no one as he answers the voice of the broken king who has come to whisper this question: who among the numberless you have become desires this moment, which comprehends nothing more than loss and fragility and the fleeing of flesh? And the answer of Larry Levis sounds out not only the cry of carpe diem, seize the day, and his answer not only speaks for us all in this very moment, but it also continues to speak for him from beyond the grave. Who desires this moment? Me. I do. It's mine.
This poem is called Elegy with a Bridle in Its Hand. One was a bay cow horse from Piedra, and the other was a washed-out palomino. And both stood at the rail of the corral, and both went on aging in each effortless tail swish, the flies rising, then congregating again around their eyes and muzzles and withers. Their front teeth were by now yellow as antique piano keys and slanted to the angle of shingles on the maze of sheds and barns around them. Their puckered chins were round and black as frostbitten oranges hanging unpicked from the limbs of trees all through winter, and like a comment of winter itself on everything that led up to it, and gradually found the way out again, in the slowness of time, rind the blossom. Deity is in the details, and we are details among other details, and we long to be teased out of ourselves and become all of them. The bay had worms once and had acquired the habit of drinking orange soda from an up-tilted bottle and nibbling cookies from the flat of a hand, and liked to do nothing else now. And the Palomino liked to do nothing but gaze off at traffic going past on the road beyond vineyards, and it would follow each car with a slight turning of its neck back and forth, as if each car was a thing of great interest to it. If I rode them, the Palomino would stumble and wheeze when it broke into a trot and would relapse into a walk after a second or two and then stop completely and without cause. The bay would keep going, though it creaked underneath me like a rocking chair of dry, frail wood. And when I knew it could no longer continue but did so anyway, or when the Palomino would stop and then take only a step or two when I nudged it forward again, I would slip off, whichever one it was, and walk it slowly back, letting it pause when it wanted to. At dawn in winter, sometimes there would be a pane of black ice covering the surface of the water trough, and they would nudge it with their noses or muzzles and stare at it as if they were capable of wonder or bewilderment. They were worthless. They were the motionless dusk and the motionless moonlight, and in moonlight they were other worlds, worlds uninhabited and without visitors, worlds that would cock an ear a moment when the migrant workers came back at night to the sheds they were housed in and turn a radio on, but only for a moment before they went back to whatever wordless and tuneless preoccupation involved them. The Palomino was called Misfit, and the bay was called Querido Flaco, and the names of some of the other shapes had been Rockabye and Ojo Pendejo and Cue Ball and Backdoor Peter and French Fry and Sandman and Rolling Ghost and Anastasia. Death would come for both of them with its bridle of clear water in hand, and they would not look up from grazing on some patch of dry grass, nor even acknowledge it much. And for a while I began to think that the world rested on a limitless ossuary of horses, where their bones and skulls stretched and fused until only the skeleton of one enormous horse underlay, the smoke of cities and the cold branches of trees and the distant whine of traffic on the interstate. If I, and by implication, therefore, anyone looked at them long enough at dusk or in moonlight, he would know that the idea of heaven and of life everlasting with so much blown straw or momentary confetti at the unhappy wedding of a sister. Heaven was neither light, nor was it air, and if it took a physical form, it was splintered lumber no one could build anything with. Heaven was a weight behind the eyes, and one would have to stare right through it until he saw the air itself, just air, that clarity that took the shackles from his eyes and the taste of the bit from his mouth and knocked the rider off his back, so he might walk for once in his life, or just stand there for a moment until he became something else, some fly speck on the wall of a passing and uninterruptible history whose sounds claimed to be a cheering from bleachers but were actually no more than the noise of cars entering the mouth of a tunnel. And in the years that followed, he would watch them in the back stretch or the far turn at Santa Anita or Del Mar. Watch the way they made it all seem effortless. Watch the way they were explosive and untiring. And then watch the sun fail them again and slip from the world. And watch the stand slowly empty, as if all moments came back to this one. Inexplicably to this one, out of all he might have chosen. Heaven with ashes in its hair and filling what were once its eyes. This one with its torn tickets littering the aisles and the soft racket the wind made. This one, which was his. And if the voice of a broken king were to come in the night and whisper to all the world, who among the numberless you have become desires this moment, which comprehends nothing more than loss and fragility and the fleeing of flesh? He would have to look up from the thousands of empty seats surrounding him and stare up into the dark and say, me, I do, it's mine.